This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
Hello, I'm David Hatfield, and this is Classical Music Connection. Let's find out what's on today's program. In the January 2024 edition of the BBC Music Magazine, Terry Blaine tells us the story of how Gustav Mahler ended up in America. The phrase annus horribilis might easily have been invented to describe the string of spirit-weakening events that struck Gustav Mahler in the year 1907. First, his 10-year tenure as director of the court opera in Vienna ended. Crippled by ongoing disputes with management and performers, and by a virulently anti-Semitic campaign against him in the press. Then, in July, his 4-year-old daughter Maria died of diphtheria. Shortly afterwards, Mahler was diagnosed with a heart defect, heaping further anxiety on both himself and his wife Alma. These hammer blows of fate might easily have felled the 47-year-old composer and conductor, but Mahler, a famously combative and dynamic individual, was by no means ready to capitulate. Anticipating his ouster from the court opera, on the 21st of June 1907, he had signed a lucrative contract with the Metropolitan Opera in New York, earning over twice his Vienna salary for a third of the work. On the 12th of December, Mahler and Alma set sail from Cherbourg, arriving in Manhattan 9 days later. The couple's first impressions of New York were mainly positive. The Met's management, keen to impress its illustrious new recruit, had installed the Mahlers in a lavishly appointed suite at the Hotel Majestic, with views over Central Park. "Many rooms! 2 grand pianos, of course," enthused Alma. "So we felt at home." When he went to the opera house itself, however, Gustav was somewhat less enthusiastic. Minutes into his first rehearsal of Wagner's Tristan und Isolde, he stopped the players, distracted by the chorus rehearsing close by in the lobby. "All other rehearsals in this theater must be stopped," he declared. "I can't hear my orchestra." He was also unimpressed with those who ran the Met on a day-to-day basis. These managers, producers, stage managers were, he fumed, guilty of absolute incompetence and fraudulent activities, making the outlook for the opera bleak. The performance of Tristan und Isolde, which took place on the 1st of January 1908, just 11 days after Mahler arrived in New York, was an entirely different proposition. The Met had chosen wisely in giving Mahler Tristan for his house debut. His 1903 staging in Vienna, with modernistic designs by Alfred Roller, had been sensationally successful, redefining the art of Wagner interpretation. Roller had not accompanied Mahler to Manhattan, but the musical power and expressivity of Mahler's interpretation still swept all before it. "A performance remarkable in many respects," was the New York Times verdict. Absent the review continued, was the heavy, portentous style of conducting, which weighed down many Wagner productions with lead. Mahler's tempos were, by contrast, somewhat more rapid, while remaining elastic and full of subtle variations. Strikingly, Mahler also ensured the singers' voices emerged with exceptional clarity, though orchestral climaxes were still superbly effectual. The audience supplied a standing ovation, and the path seemed clear for a long, mutually beneficial relationship to develop between the Metropolitan Opera and its newest star conductor. In the event, Mahler stayed just 2 years with the company, his initial positivity sapped by the lower artistic standards he encountered compared to Vienna, and by the arrival of Arturo Toscanini on the Met's conducting roster. But Mahler was by no means finished with the Big Apple. In February 1909, he became principal conductor of the New York Philharmonic, leading a resurgent orchestra to, quote, new pinnacles of achievement, unquote. A Carnegie Hall concert with the ensemble on the 21st of February 1911 was the last he conducted. Just 3 months later, he died of endocarditis in Vienna, age 50, leaving his 10th symphony incomplete. In the June 2021 edition of Pianist Magazine, Jessica Duchin interviews French pianist Lisa de La Salle. When the pandemic struck, the French pianist Lisa de La Salle was among thousands of classical musicians who found their diaries had emptied almost overnight. It's a terrifying prospect for most, but de La Salle is not someone accustomed to sitting about doing nothing. She decided to volunteer for the Red Cross. 4 days a week for 3 months, she says, she woke at 5:30 a.m. to travel across Paris in a virtually deserted metro, working to connect the neediest and most desperate people with the organization that could help them when all else had failed. The usual resources, such as soup kitchens, had closed. These people were left with literally nothing. The Red Cross created emergency grocery bags that we were sending to them, and my job was connecting the people who really needed it to the staff on the ground that were actually delivering. I was the go-between. It was extremely intense because people were living in such distress with emotional and physical emergencies, alone with nobody to help them. They really needed someone to talk to. Sometimes she would find she had worked for hours without a moment's break. Because I am used to practicing for many hours in a row, and emotionally everything hits you all at once. Musical life began to limp back in the summer. I had about one engagement a month that survived from July to December. I was in Germany, most of the Nordic countries, and Spain. Her last date of 2020 was in Beirut, Lebanon, a month and a half after a gigantic explosion at the port left a substantial section of the city devastated. That was the most emotionally strong concert in many years, also because I had been there before and loved it. She was thrilled to come back after the explosion and see people alive and warm and welcoming. Moreover, this was her first concert since the pandemic's onset that admitted a live audience rather than streaming only. It was in a big church with half capacity allowed, which meant 500 people. When you go for months with absolutely no contact with the audience, then suddenly, in those circumstances with such a high level of emotions around, To play for 500 people was totally surreal and wonderful. De La Salle, though only 33, has been a familiar and much-loved figure on the musical circuit for over 15 years. On the Zoom screen from her apartment near Paris, she comes across as intelligent, perceptive, and in some ways wise beyond her years, as artists sometimes can be after starting stellar careers so young. And her English is excellent, partly thanks to 3 years she spent living in New York. She was born in Paris to parents more Russian than French in origin. 3 of my 4 grandparents were from Russian families who had escaped after the revolution in 1917, she says. If she has escaped the perennial curse of French pianists, being pigeonholed into playing French repertoire, this may partly account for it. I've always felt a big affinity with Russian music, she says. I like those extreme emotions and that kind of emotional gravity. Sometimes I think that the more intensity I get, the better I feel, even if it's not always a good thing. She has all the Rachmaninoff concertos under her belt, though the one piece she has not tackled yet, but dreams of playing, is the Tchaikovsky Piano Concerto No. 1, a big monster that somehow I have never had the occasion to work on. She grew up in a very arty environment. Her father's side of the family were gallerists and art dealers, and her mother's were musical. My grandma was a piano teacher, and my mom loves music and used to be a singer. We had a piano, and when I was 4 years old, I spontaneously was attracted by the instrument. So I started to play around with it. My mom decided to give me some lessons at the Conservatoire Rachmaninoff. The Conservatoire Russe de Paris, to which Rachmaninoff lent his name, was located in a historic mansion in central Paris. Probably as we are Russian heritage, she found it cool, De La Salle quips. I started there and immediately adored it. I don't remember this, but the family legends goes that I told my piano teacher at my second lesson that I will be a concert pianist. It was all decided. And after that, I never stopped. I never questioned it. I never wanted to do anything else. As time went by, the type of life she was approaching became clearer. The long hours of hard slog, the devotion to work rather than being a teenager, and the incompatibility with normal schooling. I was homeschooled from the age of 10, she says. She was able to go through the entire education system and take her baccalaureate this way. Her big break came when the founder of the Naive Classique label, Hervé Boisière, who also founded Medici TV, decided to take a punt on her. Naive was a very young label at the time, only 3 years old. This was the early 2000s, and perhaps it was a slightly crazy thing to create a new label then. But he did it, and he decided to sign me up when I was 14. He's that kind of guy, with big intuition and loving to take risks, which is also one of my mottos. If you don't risk anything, nothing happens. So he did it. It worked, and then with the first CD came my first agent. At this point, one might like to think the rest is history, but it's not quite so simple. Becoming a professional pianist before you're even old enough to vote is a tall order. The last 2 or 3 school years were very difficult because I was starting to have a full concert schedule while also the baccalaureate was approaching. That time between 16 and 18 was crazy. and I'm glad it's over. Everything went well in the end, but it really felt like I was only working, practicing, or traveling, and my life was not fun. De La Salle steamed ahead thanks to, she says, some valuable advice from her mother. My mom once explained to me, and it made sense, these were the years where all my life would be created, and it would be worth it so that I could then arrange everything afterwards in the way I wanted. Of course, nothing is ever guaranteed, but at least I was doing all that was necessary to give myself the chance later on. Not only playing the piano, but also having more time and more opportunities to see my friends and travel the world. Up until COVID happened, I really had a dream life. I'm very thankful that I could do it this way. She stopped taking lessons when she was 18, and since then has forged her own path, choosing to find her guidance largely from the examples set by the great pianists of the past. The most wonderful teachers are on the internet, those video recordings on YouTube, she says. I still learn a lot just by watching and listening, trying to comprehend and trying to copy. I often compare this to when you see students in museums sketching Leonardo da Vinci. It's when you try to copy the old masters that you begin to find your own way, and then you can build your individual approach. My technique was pretty solid already. I had made a couple of recordings. I had played with orchestras. What I needed was to grow and mature. I think it's like a good wine. Being French, I have to make that comparison, she jokes. But it needs time. There is no magic recipe. I am firmly a believer in life being the best teacher. She has few good words, however, for a piano world that often appears to value recorded technical perfection ahead of emotional communication with the audience. For me, this is a nonsense, because when you hear Horowitz, Lipati, Gilels, Richter, Kempf, all those guys who are my heroes, they do play wrong notes. I'm not saying that playing wrong notes is wonderful. It should, of course, be avoided as much as we can. But accuracy should not be the primary focus and goal. What's important is what you say and how you sing with your instrument, what kind of message you give, what emotions you provide. If you're only focused on playing all the correct notes, there is clearly not much energy or brains left to create that magic and emotion. I think it's a little bit too sterile. Staying motivated to keep making music is not easy when performances are being scheduled, canceled, rescheduled, and canceled again. And when an industry that normally relies on planning 2 years or more in advance can't see further than a few weeks into the future. De La Salle has found it valuable, though, to focus on making a new recording, a type of concept album. When Do We Dance? The title taken from the Gershwin song. Exploring classical composers' responses to dance forms around the world between 1850 and 1950. She was able to go to Berlin, where the recording took place at the Teldec studio, a space I adored when I went there before to record with violinist Daniel Hope, she says. It was just me, the engineer, and the artistic director, so social distancing was not an issue. If the album kept her busy and smiling, it may well do likewise for its listeners. And it certainly brought this writer some cherishable good spirits. Besides, perhaps the effects of the pandemic are not all bad. We need our lives back, says De La Salle. But maybe we don't need to return to those crazy schedules. I love to cook, and though I'm no expert, I'm very interested in healthy food and what's good for you. I do a lot of sports, yoga, meditation, and all of those things. Sometimes I felt life was a bit like empty calories, feeding ourselves with trash food, no matter what kind of food, it can be real or emotional. Just to feel like there is no time to think and keep on rolling, rolling, rolling. But why and for what? I hope it's going to be a good effect that people realize we need quality time to share things that are meaningful. What matters is not quantity, but quality. Have you ever considered a vacation to the shores of Greece in order to get more music? In the October 2023 edition of the BBC Music magazine, Charlotte Smith visits the island paradise of Spetses in Greece with a proud naval history, newly enhanced by a music academy for young performers. To appreciate fully all that the island of Spetses has to offer, it's important to see it from the back of a moped. It's from this vantage point that I find myself taking in clear azure waters, fragrant pines, bright white sailing boats, and the many intimate coves and beaches as my guide, architect and president of the Arnagirios and Korgiolenios School of Spetses, Petros Petrikopoulos, nimbly races around sharp bends and up steep hills, all the while pointing out interesting landmarks. As my very real terror gives way to wide-eyed wonder, I understand why it's crucial that this small island, just 2 miles off the coast of the Greek mainland, prohibits cars, bar the odd delivery van and taxi. And why a whopping 42% is owned by the AKSS Foundation, which seeks to protect its historic vegetation and architecture and discourages all but the most discreet building. In fact, the town of Spetses is the only large settlement on the island. Here, affluent, mainly Greek tourists enjoy fine dining in the many glamorous outdoor bars and cafes centered around 2 main harbors, each paying testament to the island's naval history. In the main dock is a statue of Lascarina Bubulina, admiral and heroine of the Greek War of Independence. Further along, the old harbor forms the backdrop every September to a commemoration of the victory of 1822, in which a Turkish flotilla was torched by bold Greek revolutionaries. At the center of the town is the Poseidonian Hotel, built in 1914 in the style of its French counterparts by Sotirios Anargyros, descendant of a great shipping family and tobacco tycoon in his own right. Anargyros was responsible for reintroducing pine seedlings to the hills of the island, at the time in danger of extinction due to excessive logging, and for founding the AKSS, a premier boarding school for boys based on the British models of Eton and Harrow, and attended for a time by the composer Ioannis Xenakis. Though closed in 1983, the school's buildings are today used for conferences and events, and for the last 3 years by the Music Academy of AKSS, the brainchild of Leni Koniolidis. Establishing a 10-day program of masterclasses in multiple disciplines, alongside year-long music initiation workshops for local children, not to mention free public performances, is difficult under any circumstances. But Koniolidis managed the feat during the first year of the pandemic, with full testing and masks. So, this third edition, running from the 24th of July to the 2nd of August, and welcoming 64 students aged 12 to 30 from all over the world, seems a walk in the park. Attending a selection of masterclasses, all open to the public, during my first full day at the Academy, I encounter numerous nuggets of wisdom from the professors instructing students in seven disciplines: voice, flute, trombone, violin, cello, and new additions for this season, clarinet and viola. "It's too beautiful. It needs to be drier," says violin tutor Bartek Nidziol, as a student performs with an undeniable sweetness of tone that nevertheless lacks dramatic conviction. Meanwhile, in the flute class, instructor Stefan Reti is giving a lesson in communication as a welcome sea breeze drifts through the open windows. "We need to understand your text like a singer," he says. "This music is full of love, hope, and tenderness." Viola professor Jean-Éric Soucy describes a lesson from earlier in the day in which a chamber ensemble for two flutes and viola, formed for the course, came to understand the value of working together. "The only way to learn music is to play with better people than yourself and to grow," he says. That lesson is demonstrated in spades as the trio play with great sensitivity at one of three performances I attend during my stay in the Poseidonian Hotel in the beautiful courtyard of the Church of Agios Nikolaos, and finally an appropriate send-off in the outdoor amphitheater of AKSS. Performing for tourists and locals in interesting locations around the island is a hallmark of the Music Academy. I'm reliably informed that an outdoor harbor concert given by a large ensemble of trombones attracted a lot of interest. And in the end, the Academy is providing so much, not only for its students, but for the wider community. As the sun sets behind the pines at the closing concert, the full contingent of students appears on stage together as 2023's newly formed Chamber Orchestra and Chorus for a performance of "Time to Say Goodbye," for this year at any rate, as here is an initiative that is set to grow and grow. You've been listening to Classical Music Connection, brought to you each week by the Radio Reading Services of Greater Cincinnati, a service of the Cincinnati Association for the Blind and Visually Impaired. I'm your host, David Hatfield, inviting you to join me again next week for Classical Music Connection.